To be here and appreciate the organizers for the invitation to join you. What I'm going to do is try to provide a little perspective on physiological limits for crop yield and if there are some boundaries that we can look at for the resources that crops need to achieve these yields. With that in mind, what I'd like to do is think about particular resources that we will utilize and discuss in the remainder of the talk: nutrients, water, and solar radiation. And then I want to spend just a few minutes talking about prospects for improving resource utilization for crop yield. So to begin with, I'd like to begin looking at crop response to nutrients. This is really kind of the foundation from which crop physiology sprang, is the understanding of how crops respond to nutrients. And just a generalized cartoon of what we generally think of when we think of crop response to nutrients. On the y-axis, the crop response, this might be yield or it might be biomass, and on the x-axis, we're looking at increased resource availability. And what you see there is the concept of diminishing returns. At high levels of resource availability, we have diminished crop response. The solid line that is plotted there is the Mitscherlich equation, and a general interpretation of that is that high levels of resource availability, there are other limitations for crop yield, not necessarily the resource that is being evaluated. There's lots and lots of examples of this general response in the literature, and just to look at one to illustrate this. In this particular example, that we're looking at wheat and triticale response to phosphorus nutrient supply. This is a potted study, so we're looking at shoot dry weight response. And what is plotted there is the Mitscherlich equation, just showing this concept of diminishing returns. It's a little bit more complicated when there's more than one nutrient limitation to yield. And just to illustrate this is looking at rice yield response to nitrogen fertilization. And the lower line here, where we're looking at 0 kilograms of, in this case, K2O that was added, we see no response or perhaps a decreasing response to nitrogen fertilization. And as we add potassium fertilizer, we see, again, an increasing response to nitrogen fertilizer. But when you're having many, many different nutrients that are suboptimal, it's very often to distinguish what is the critical value that you need to apply your fertilizer, because all of these things are interacting. We generally take for granted that our soil test is doing a good job of evaluating this and we can fertilize accordingly. I think it's a moving target somewhat when we're looking at new cultivars, new hybrids that may have different nutrient requirements. And so this is something that I think that really is underappreciated when we think about what our potential yield is in different environments. Our nutrient use in the United States, and is shown here, we're looking at, on the y-axis, nutrient use in thousands of tons versus years. What I'd like to point out is from around 1960 to 1980, P and K rate increased very steadily. And between 1980 and present, we have a decreasing amounts of P and K use, amounts of P and K use. From 1960 to 1980, again, we see nitrogen fertilizer use has increased very rapidly. Since about 1980, we see a leveling off of the amount of nitrogen use. I think part of the issue with the leveling off of P and K and the leveling off of nitrogen may be related to cost. We're looking at fertilizer cost here on the y-axis in $1991 dollars versus time over from 1960 to 2005. From around 1960 to 1976 or so, prices were relatively flat. Since 1975 or so, we've seen a relatively steady increase in fertilizer costs up to around 2000. And since 2000 up to 2005, we've had a fairly sharp increase. From 2005, about right here in this graph, to present, we've had a very, very large increase in all of our fertilizer costs. And I think it's part of the real concern is the volatility in fertilizer cost on a global scale that is really threatening. It does not allow farmers to plan ahead, and particularly in third world countries, developing countries, the response that farmers get from small amounts of fertilizer application is really a key issue, and having the price volatility threatens a lot of that productivity. I'd like to turn now and think about crop response to water and water use. Certainly water is a primary resource that crops need, and in the future it looks like this is going to be a more and more critical issue. The availability of fresh water sources is very limited, and agricultural's competition with urban needs is a real constraint in many environments. Much of what we know about plant response to water use has been described in the literature very well in the past. This is DeWitt's analysis of plant mass gain on the y-axis versus transpiration normalized by pan evaporation. And his analysis in 1959, a lot of it went back to work that was done in the early 1900s by Briggs and Shantz. I've plotted just two of the species here that DeWitt analyzed. And what we want to look at here is a couple of things. The sorghum response here is shown in the black, and the wheat response is shown in the red. For both the species, what's really important is if you decrease the amount of water that the crop transpires, you have a linear decrease in crop mass. The same could be shown for yield. But that's the first critical part. A second critical part is that although Briggs and Shantz were able to distinguish plants that had very high water use efficiency values, such as sorghum here, they distinguished also species that had very low values of water use efficiency. And without really knowing why this occurred, they separated out C4 from C3 species. So the water use efficiency, of course, between C4 and C3 species is very different. I want to look for just very briefly at an equation or two that describes water use efficiency, and then we'll look at some of the implications of that. I want to just focus on this equation right here. Water use efficiency is equal to the carbon dioxide gradient from the atmosphere, C sub A, to inside the leaf. And we'll look at the denominator here, the water vapor concentration from inside the leaf to the atmosphere. So this kind of sets up on a leaf basis how water use efficiency works. So a couple of things this says is that we can increase water use efficiency by increasing the atmospheric CO2 concentration, which we're doing a very good job of at the present. And also we can increase water use efficiency by lowering the internal CO2 concentration, which goes along with photosynthesis. Likewise, we can increase water use efficiency by having a higher water vapor concentration in the atmosphere in which we grow our crops. Finally, before we go to the next slide, I just want you to recognize that the numerator and the equation at the top of the page can also be expressed slightly differently, where we're including here this ratio of CI to CA, the internal CO2 concentration to the atmospheric CO2 concentration. So the figure that I want to show you now, these are not meant to be any data from particularly in the literature, but are representative of many different experiments. We're looking at leaf photosynthetic rate versus the intercellular CO2 concentration. And currently, our ambient CO2 concentration is somewhere in the neighborhood of 375 to 380 parts per million. And if we have this ratio of CI to CA, the internal CO2 concentration to the atmospheric CO2 concentration of around 0.7, which is typical for C3 species, and if we're able to drop that to around 0.6, we've increased our water use efficiency. Estimates are that if we can drop the internal this ratio to around 0.6, we could expect on a leaf level water use efficiency to increase approximately 30%. There's a trade-off with that. There's a slight decrease in this example of 6% decrease in photosynthetic capacity on the leaf level. The way plants are able to decrease their CO2 concentration is because of a stomatal limitation. The slope here between the ambient CO2 concentration and the internal CO2 concentration represents the stomatal conductance. And so as you decrease stomatal conductance, you're able to, and partially close the stomates, you're able to decrease the CO2 concentration inside the leaf. Of course, there are other options for increasing water use efficiency by increasing the photosynthetic capacity. In this case, you're still maintaining the same stomatal conductance, but by having higher photosynthetic capacity, you've still been able to maintain that low internal CO2 concentration. Now, the idea of this CI to CA ratio has been put to good use in a physiological and in a breeding sense through rapid selections. The Australian group, Condon and his colleagues, Richard Richards and others, have used this CI to CA ratio and the relationship of carbon isotope discrimination. For C3 plants, the discrimination between C13 and C12 is associated with this internal, the CI to CA ratio and the water use efficiency. In the bottom panel here, we're looking at water use efficiency versus this isotope discrimination. So high values of isotope discrimination mean that we have low values of water use efficiency. They've used this in breeding programs along with several other measurements that they've used effectively in screening programs. We're looking at the yield advantage of one of their wheat varieties from this program. What you see is that we're looking at this plotted against the environmental mean. When yields are very low due to drought stress, there's about a 10% bump in varieties and the variety selected for isotope water use efficiency. And as we move to higher yield environments, we still are able to maintain a slight yield advantage, or certainly not a yield decrease. So there's not a negative trade-off with the yield advantage due to this water use efficiency in these environments. I've also been involved in some research that has looked at differences in among soybean genotypes and how rapidly they wilt in particular environments. We've looked at the radiation use efficiency, which you can think of as a long-term measure of photosynthetic capacity under well-watered conditions, for a range of genotypes that include fast-wilting genotypes, and we'll focus on the slow-wilting genotypes. Generally, what we see is the fast-wilting genotypes tend to have higher rates of radiation use efficiency, higher radiation use efficiency values. The slow-wilting genotypes tend to have lower values of radiation use efficiency. Again, this is under well-watered conditions, and it appears that one of the reasons that these slow-wilting genotypes have are slow-wilting is that the lower values of radiation use efficiency allows them to conserve soil moisture during the onset of drought. Tom Sinclair and others in his lab have looked at the transpiration of several of these lines as a function of the vapor pressure deficit. The two genotypes that are shown here at the top are fast wilting genotypes, and the analysis that they've shown is that both of the fast wilting genotypes have a linear response of transpiration to increasing vapor pressure deficit. One of the slow wilting genotypes, PI416937, has a very, very different response. Transpiration in this genotype increases as vapor pressure deficit goes from 1 to 2, and above a vapor pressure deficit of 2, we have no further increase in transpiration. It's able to limit the amount of transpiration when evaporative demand is very, very high. A second slow wilting genotype, PI471938, has a response that's much more similar to the fast wilting genotypes. That is a linear increase in transpiration with increasing vapor pressure deficit. We've also looked at carbon isotope discrimination and some of the work that we and a former student have been involved in. I want to just point out a couple of things. We have fast wilting genotypes here, and within this fast wilting group, we have genotypes that based upon carbon isotope discrimination, would it be expected to have high values of water use efficiency, And we have also genotypes that would be expected to have low values of carbon isotope discrimination. Likewise, among the slow wilting genotypes, the PI416937, which was the one that limited transpiration under high VPD, it has very inefficient very inefficient water use efficiency, and PI471938 has a much more higher water use efficiency. So there appear to be different mechanisms that lead to these same slow wilting phenotype. Combinations of these traits may be something in the future that would be very valuable. We've looked also at management options that might be able to improve water use efficiency. This is a line source irrigation system where we're able to have seven different water availability treatments over a range of genotypes. This is in soybean, and we're evaluating genotypes from maturity group 1 through 5 under a range of different water regimes. When we've looked at grain yield and soybean for these different soybean maturity groups from very early to what would be considered traditional in Arkansas at a latitude of around 35 to 36 degrees. We see a wide range of yield response as the total amount of water applied during the season as both irrigation and rainfall increases. When we look at this by maturity group, what we see is that our early maturing cultivars, maturity groups 1, 2, and 3, have a much steeper slope compared to our maturity groups 4 and 5, and in which the slope lessens. It's also important to note that our highest yields that we have among these maturity groups, 2, 3, 4, and 5, are actually the same. But what you'll note is that our maturity group 2 cultivar uses or has available to it approximately 200 millimeters less water than does our full season cultivar. When we look at this on a water use efficiency basis, based upon grain yield and the amount of water that's applied during the season, we see about a threefold difference in water use efficiency among these lines. So having a sequence of cultivars or varieties in lower latitudes that are shorter in duration may improve our capture of water use efficiency. 5 minutes, okay, I need to move along. I'd like to look at solar radiation very, very briefly as a resource. Our traditional views of classical crop physiology would tell us that crop mass accumulation is proportional to solar radiation intercepted. This is the concept of radiation use efficiency. And if harvest index is not affected, we can increase our yield simply by increasing the cumulative amount of solar radiation. How can we do that? Well, a couple of ways. We can lengthen the growing season by using later maturing crops. We can also change the geometry of planting patterns, narrow rows, increase populations. One of the questions is, does this really work and for increasing our yields? And in many cases, this is not the case. We're not able to increase yield related to increasing solar radiation interception. So this is our traditional view of what we can expect. We'll just look at the top panel. We're looking at biomass accumulation in soybean versus the cumulative amount of radiation intercepted. The solid circles here represent total biomass. We see a nice linear response here, the slope being the radiation use efficiency. I'm going to skip through this slide, and we'll just look at a slightly different view. This is looking at soybean yield expressed on a relative basis versus the cumulative amount of light intercepted during a growing season. In this particular experiment, we had soybean maturities ranging from 0 to 6 and a wide range of population densities to vary the amount of light intercepted. What we see is a very curvilinear response, not a linear response. And what we are able to do is you can calculate a critical value, much like you would for a nutrient experiment, and we can anticipate that we would receive about 90% of our yield with about 610 megajoules per meter squared of light energy intercepted. This is compared to a full season cultivar that would intercept approximately 1,000 megajoules per meter squared. So we're again, using a shorter sequence clock, a shorter sequence crop that is able to have a higher efficiency of solar radiation interception. Likewise, the amount of water that this crop had during the growing season was substantially less. What are our future prospects for resource utilization? I want to mention, I think, a view that Ford Denison had in a review related to Darwinian agriculture. Ford noted that any new phenotype that could be achieved through minor genetic changes is likely to have been tested by natural selection repeatedly in the past, and that changes that would consistently have improved individual competitiveness in pre-agricultural environments will have already been incorporated by natural selection. I want to point out three words that Ford has in here. Minor genetic changes would be one or two changes perhaps in promoter strength or perhaps in one or two amino acid changes. Also, individual competitiveness, that crops, that natural selection works on individuals. When we're talking about crops, we're talking about a community of plants, not just the competitiveness of an individual crop. And pre-agricultural environments. Many of the environments that we're talking about for today are not the same ones under which crops evolve. For example, CO2 concentrations and nutrient levels. So there may be ways that we can continue to improve yields in those environments. As an example, Ford recognized or asked the question, can photosynthesis increase yield potential? 45 years of physiological research has really not shown a large increase in yield related to photosynthesis. Denison noted that C4 photosynthesis has evolved at least 31 times independently, and more than likely this is closer to 45 times independently, and that changes much less radical than C4 photosynthesis will likely already have been tested and rejected by natural selection. So, Tom Sinclair and I looked at some theoretical assumptions of if we could increase Rubisco content expression for the large and small subunit, what would we expect to see in the way of increased yields? What I want to just run through real quickly, as you increase the complexity of the system in which you're evaluating, that you have diminished returns on what you would expect the yield to actually be. By the time you look at grain yield with no additional nitrogen with additional nitrogen added, you have a 5% increase in yield. Without additional nitrogen, you have around a 5% decrease. So as the level of complexity increases, the return, likely return, also decreases. This is looking at photosynthetic response and yield response of grain yield in the top panel versus net photosynthesis versus CO2 concentration in rice. The CO2 concentration of 400 parts per million or so results in a flat level of both grain yield and photosynthesis. Of course, there's great interest in creating a C4 type rice crop. What you'll notice is that projected CO2 concentrations around the time period that this would expected to occur, around 2030 or so, are close to reaching that 450 or so part per million range in which our C3 rice crop would be achieved. Just some final thoughts. Crop growth depends upon these acquiring these natural these resources of nutrients, water, and solar radiation. The volatility in fertilizer prices places an extreme risk for many farmers. Improving yield by simple genetic traits is unlikely without some sorts of trade-offs. And breeding for environments to which crops have not been exposed may continue to increase yield. And finally, the efficiency of water and radiation use in lower latitudes may be greater by using a sequence of short season crops.
Thanks very much, sir. So, we have about 3 minutes for some.
The question was, any suggestions on mechanism for water use efficiency with specific to the earlier maturing? Partly it's that they're grown in a cooler part of the season when vapor pressure deficit is not so high, so the evaporative demand is not so high. We have looked also at seeing if we could normalize the vapor pressure deficit in those among those different maturity groups. And still, even with normalizing vapor pressure deficit, they're more efficient in their water use. So that's not all the answer, but it's part of it. The question was response. The question was the transpiration response to VPD differed among genotypes, and could part of the reason be the patchiness of stomatal response under different conditions? I'm not going to go too far in that. Maybe Tom's going to fill us in on that tomorrow and another talk that he's giving. No, he's shaking his head no. It's certainly very possible that this is part of the response that we're seeing there. Okay, if I understood the question correctly, how do we relate physiological water use efficiency, perhaps at a leaf level, with agronomic water use efficiency at the field level? And I think that's a real challenge. The paper that I showed from Condon et al. From Journal of Experimental Botany goes through a lot of the different caveats that are associated with looking at water use efficiency on the leaf level and how very often it does not translate into water use efficiency at the field level. For example, one example that they showed very eloquently was that when you close stomates partially and are able to conserve moisture, you heat the leaves, and this causes the vapor pressure gradient between the inside of the leaf and the atmosphere to increase, and that increases transpiration. So there's a lot of different trade-offs that are discussed, and I think that that's part of the problem, that using this carbon isotope discrimination is not the savior for looking at improving water use efficiency on an agronomic level.
Good. Let's show our appreciation.